Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. This is our president's morning off. I saw her last night and said, so what are you going to do tomorrow morning? She said, sleep. So it's almost too pretty a morning to sleep. Prairie, as you know, welcomes people of all religious, racial, and ethnic backgrounds and all sexual orientations. We're a lay-led congregation. And I'm here officially as the wife of the program committee chair. It's like, if Miss America can't serve, we're down to about this 15th runner-up. My name's Arne Schroeder, and we're going to start by having Robin do the chalice lighting, and then it'll be followed by a moment of silence.
I chose the chalice lighting reading in observance of Father's Day, so it's number 715 in the hymnal, responsive reading. Make sure everybody's awake. It's by Khalil Gibran, called Your Children. Does everybody have it? Your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. You may give them your love, but not your thoughts, for they have their own thoughts.
You may house their bodies, but not their souls, for their souls dwell in the house of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, but beyond in your dreams.
You may strive to be like them, but seek not to make them like you. Oh, for life goes not backward, nor tarries with yesterday. The archer sees the mark upon the path of the infinite and bends you with might, that the arrows might may go swift and far. Good morning, everybody. For those of you who haven't been here for all of the services, this is the sixth and final installment of the lay ministry that I've been doing the past year on UUs and sexuality. And so I thought I'd just briefly recap what we've done before. The first service, I gave an overview of the history of sexuality issues in the Unitarian and Universalist faiths. The second service was a presentation from James Reeb, who went through the Our Whole Lives sexuality curriculum last year as middle schoolers and their facilitators. Then there were two sections on the Our Whole Lives for Adults curriculum, which we reviewed some of the exercises and some of the principles of Our Whole Lives, which is the UUA's brand new comprehensive lifespan sexuality education. And the most recent service was given by Paige Shipman from Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin, who talked about sexuality education issues in the schools. So I thought I would wrap things up by introducing the manual, which is a UUA resource called the Advocacy Manual for Sexuality Education, Health, and Justice, which is edited by Sarah Gibb. And basically what it talks about is what comprehensive sexuality education is, how to promote it and advocate for it, both in your congregations and in the community at large. And so many of the ideas that I will present to you today come directly from this manual, which will be in our library downstairs, and anybody is free to look at. And again, as I've said before, that any original ideas that are in this service are purely accidental. This is Boston. This is out of UUA, and it's a companion to the OWL curriculum. Okay. Now, one of the things that has said a couple times during this lay ministry is that official UUA thinking towards sexuality has changed since the 70s, when the About Your Sexuality curriculum was the curriculum that was used in religious education. The curriculum now places much more of an emphasis on justice and wholeness than on personal pleasure. Okay. But the two ideas of justice and pleasure are not necessarily mutually exclusive. They are connected by the idea that we should be able to express our sexual selves freely and openly without fear of discrimination or violence or unwanted sexual attention. And this is the way it's summed up in the preface to this manual. We believe that humans seek meaning in life and organize into religious communities to pursue meaning as a common endeavor. We believe that sexuality can enrich life and thus is an essential concern of religious communities. We recognize that people can encounter the spiritual through sexual expression. Therefore, we believe the religious community must take an active role in the promotion of education and justice in human sexuality. To accomplish this, religious communities must engage in a wide range of activities and address the whole person through worshiping, nurturing, educating, supporting, challenging, forgiving, and healing. So there's an assumption or an argument here that sexuality is spiritual, it is religious, it's something that religious communities should be concerned with, and it's also the general issues of sexuality and sexual justice and sexual politics in the culture at large need to be addressed and need to be attacked by religious liberals. Otherwise, we leave the field to religious conservatives who have the loudest voices and often the most resources and the best organizations and so forth. So it's really important for religious liberals to enter the discussion, to enter the conversation, and also to identify themselves as religious people when they do this. Otherwise, it's easy to leave yourself open to attacks of being immoral, secular, godless, and so on. And you know, that's probably not a way we generally like to think about ourselves. Some of you might. Well, I guess in caricature, sure. Certain stereotypes. If you're secular and godless. Well, we have different ways. Actually, it's a good question, because in this manual, I noticed that a lot of the language is a little bit more, let's say, in the center, or a little more conservative than the language we use around here. They're not really shy in this book about using words like church and worship and God and things like that, which, you know, we don't often hear inside this room and around here. But I think, you know, just use whatever synonyms you like. We are part of a faith community, or at least a religious community, if that word's not too offensive to anybody. And so as members of a community with a certain set of beliefs upon which we agree, I think we can go forth into the public sphere as a religious people or as a community and fight for sexual justice or advocate for sexual justice. So let's say if you wanted to be an advocate for sexuality education, this is the manual that would help you get there. And the first thing you need to do is to understand the purposes and principles of comprehensive sexuality education and how it differs from other forms of sexuality education. Okay. What is comprehensive sexuality education? I've discussed this a little bit before, but I thought it's probably worth reviewing. First of all, it understands sexuality as an essential part of every person, one that affects our identity and our relationships throughout life. It does not limit itself to discussion of sexual feelings and acts, but includes both reproductive health, interpersonal relationships, body image, and gender roles. Secondly, it involves education for the lifespan. It's just not for the kiddies. Okay? It's for adults, it's for middle-aged people, it's for the elderly, it's for people who are single, it's for people who are married, it's for people who are questioning, it's for everyone. And that feeds into the third attribute of comprehensive sexuality. It respects the diversity of values, beliefs, orientations, and practices. The other two main types of sexuality education, and the ones are sort of the squeaky wheels that get most of the grease, are abstinence-based and abstinence-only types of education. And there are a few differences that should be noted between comprehensive sexuality education and abstinence-based or abstinence-only sexuality education. And I was going to put those in a nice handy flip chart, but I couldn't find my keys to the building this morning and got here later than I wanted. So they differ basically in five areas. Focus, rationale, goals, values, and decision-making. Comprehensive sexuality education views sexuality education as a lifelong process beginning at birth. Provides age-appropriate sexuality education through the school years and includes information on a broad range of topics. Fear-based or abstinence-only programs offers limited information about sexual behavior. The rationale of comprehensive sexuality education is the idea that sexuality education is a lifelong process that encompasses sexual development, reproductive health, as I've said. Comprehensive sexuality education includes information about abstinence as well as about contraception and STD prevention. While abstinence only, as the name says, believes that contraceptive information gives students a mixed message, so often it's missing from abstinence only. Comprehensive sexuality education programs, the goals of them are to provide accurate information about human sexuality, whereas fear-based abstinence-only programs are not accurate, and some of them have had their federal funding pulled because they provide inaccurate medical information. The values taught by comprehensive sexuality education are that in a pluralistic society, people have different values and beliefs, and the values taught by abstinence-only programs are that young people must learn the core values of right and wrong and proper sexual behavior. Decision-making. Comprehensive sexuality education trusts young people with the right information to make their own decisions. It's based on democratic assumptions and democratic principles that people with good information will make good choices. And fear-based abstinence-only sexuality education is based on the assumption that young people can't make right decisions. One reason, as I've already said, why it's important for religious communities to advocate for comprehensive sexuality education is to counter the false impression fostered by the religious right that all people of faith support the abstinence-only approach. This allows a rather skewed understanding of the relationship between religion and sexuality to dominate the public understanding. We need, as religious liberals, or liberals, or godless people, or however you want to define yourself, as people who aren't on the religious right, I guess, we need to help define what it means to be religious, or we see too much ground to the radical right on religious questions. So the manual includes a chapter on religion and sexuality. And thinking, in the West especially, and in the United States probably even more especially, thinking on sexuality has been dominated by two main views, or two common views. One is that religion is critical of sexuality. It speaks against it at every turn that it gets. And the second, another view, is that religion and sexuality have nothing to do with each other. And these two perspectives are often presented as the extent of religious perspectives towards sexuality. But there's a new theology, I think, of sexuality that's developing because of the breakdown of the authority of mainline Christian churches, because of the influence of Eastern religions, because people are beginning to question and respond to violence and issues of sexual justice. And so now theologians, even Christian theologians, are beginning to develop what they call a new theology of sexuality. And here's sort of an outline of what that theology might look like from the theologian, Christian theologian, James B. Nelson in his book, Between Two Gardens. Sexuality and spirituality are inseparable elements of full personhood. The movement toward a more healed, holistic spirituality and the movement toward a more healed, holistic sexuality cannot be separated. It is not just that they ought not to be separated. Quite literally, they cannot be. Partially what we're suffering from, we're still suffering from in our thinking about sexuality, or at least official or institutional thinking about sexuality, is this sort of hangover from the early Christian church and 1,000 years of Western philosophy that have divided the human being into flesh on one side and spirit on the other. Body on one side, soul on the other, city of God, city of man. And this goes back to the church fathers, especially St. Augustine in the 5th century. Who uttered famously, "Lord, please give me strength, but not right away." And the idea since that is that we cannot become godly, you cannot be spiritual, you cannot be religious until you've triumphed over the longings of the flesh. And that's kind of the inheritance of Christianity. And also from Christianity, that found its way into Western philosophy, and this sort of mind-body dualism has existed in Western thought for a long time. And other religious traditions, Eastern religious traditions, as you're certainly aware, really don't rely very heavily on that dualism. As a matter of fact, it's the opposite. It's trying to bridge the gap between mind and body, between spirit and flesh, which is seen to be the sort of the path to enlightenment or the good life. But in the Western tradition, in the Christian tradition, which has dominated discussion about sexuality, sexual desire is seen as the proof and the penalty of original sin. You know, Adam and Eve sinned in the Garden of Eden, and so we've had to bear the brunt, bear the guilt of that original sin. And so we've spent a lot of our lives worrying about sinfulness and worrying about redemption. But, you know, UUs reject the idea of original sin. And we reject the idea of pre-selection. We believe in universal salvation. So we throw out that idea of original sin. And so that those ideas of sexuality that are related to the idea of original sin and a mind-body dualism really aren't useful to us. And they're just not not helpful in thinking about sexuality in the 21st century. Pardon? Well, you can. The idea is you can have copulation without sin. I mean, there was copulation. Adam and Eve were fruitful and multiplied, according to Genesis. Right. So the sin, there has been a sort of a connection between that act of sexuality or that act, sexual act, and sin, but that's not the original sin, is it? Sin is eating of the fruit of the tree of knowledge. Right? But those things, of course, have been really conflated in the Western mind. Yeah, and what traditional Christian theology has done has made that sexual act sort of the foundation of sin, of human being sinfulness. And that's just not something that you use really accept, that we're sinful. Or that sex itself is sinful. Okay, so the manual contains three essays on sexuality, religion, and spirituality. And my favorite one is called The Really Good News, What the Bible Says About Sex. Because, I mean, as far as you, your knowledge of the Bible, your understanding of the Bible, what does the Bible say about sex? What kind of things have you heard? Thou shalt not do this, thou shalt not do that, thou shalt not do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Somebody had to be doing all that begetting. And then there were kings, you know, who had, 300 wives and 200 concubines, and there's a lot of, so there's, you know, talk about mixed messages. Conservatives always like to talk about the mixed messages being sent our children. I mean, just consider the mixed messages in the Bible, which is there's gang rape, there's concubinage, there's incest, there's male prostitution. There's the Song of Solomon, a celebration of sexual pleasure, really as recreation, and not necessarily for procreation. So there are mixed messages in the Bible, and so if you go back with a more sort of open-minded reading of the Bible, both the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, you might draw conclusions that are somewhat different than the conclusions that sometimes are purveyed as authoritative. Okay. This essay was written by a woman named Deborah Hafner, who's a sexologist. And she got a grant, a fellowship, to go to the Yale Divinity School and sit around and read the Bible, the Old Testament, the New Testament, and study what the Bible and what the teachings of the early church fathers said about sex. And these are some of her conclusions. So she's looking at the Bible through the eyes of a sexologist. She emerged with the opinion that far from disparaging or ignoring sexuality, a major function of Bible stories is to teach sexuality education. These are some of the earliest sex education manuals in the Bible. Many of the stories and many of the laws contain information to help people understand the important role that sexuality plays in their lives. Among other topics, the Bible is absolutely silent about masturbation, abortion, birth control, oral sex. So, you know, you have to make up your own mind about those things. There's no authority there. The mind-body dualism that we're sort of familiar with in Christianity and Western philosophy really isn't that prominent, especially in the Old Testament. It's a much later innovation. Although it dominates contemporary Christian thinking, it's not really there as much in the Bible. Starting first with the Hebrew Bible, Hafner counted more than 30 stories dealing with sexual issues. And already in Genesis, the first book of the Hebrew Bible, or the Old Testament if you prefer, sex is seen as being for recreation as well as procreation. Adam is looking for a sexual partner. Adam's looking to hook up. Okay, he's not necessarily looking to procreate. It's God that puts that idea in his head. And God kind of acts as sort of a matchmaker, even a pimp, for Adam to find a companion. And Adam rejects many potential mates, animals and fishes. I don't know about fishes, but other various kind of animals, before he falls asleep, and then God creates Eve from his rib. Okay, and then God said it is good that Adam has a partner. And sexual desire is actually, frankly, and quite sympathetically acknowledged throughout the Old Testament. And even some of the famous, more famous sexually themed Bible stories have been misleadingly interpreted. Sodom and Gomorrah. What's the story of Sodom and Gomorrah about? What's our understanding of that? What is sodomy supposed to be? Right? Homosexual intercourse, right? Between men. Okay. And we learn, if we've had any Bible learning at all, that Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, were destroyed because of all this licentiousness and homosexuality and men getting together. But actually, in Hoffner's reading of the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, the sin in Sodom and Gomorrah is not same-sex relations, but actually gang rape. What modern theologians have done with the Old Testament is have read it with much more sort of culturally sensitive eyes, with the eyes of anthropologists and historians and linguists, instead of just looking at them as authoritative texts coming down from some provider. Anybody recall the story of Onan, or familiar with the word Onanism? What is Onanism a synonym for? It means masturbation. And the story of Onan is presented often as sort of an object lesson about the sins of masturbation. But it's actually, Hoffner says, is not that at all. The sin in the story of Onan is the fact that Onan's brother has died and now he goes in to be with his brother's wife, which was a sin in his society at that time. And in order to avoid procreation with his wife, what Onan does is, as the passage goes, he casts his seed upon the ground. And so the story of Onan is not a story about the sin of masturbation, but it's a story about the restrictions in this culture, in this time, on coupling with the brother's wife. But it's been interpreted as some sort of lesson about masturbation. Overall, the Bible contains only 4 verses about same-sex gender relations, 2 in Leviticus and 2 in the New Testament. And the ones in Leviticus are they're the tough ones. Those are the hard ones, the ones that are always sort of trotted out by the religious rite. The first is, you shall not lie with a man as with a woman. It is an abomination. And if a man lies with a male as with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall be put to death. Their blood is upon them. And that's the favorite of Fred Phelps and his ilk, those people. They like to quote Leviticus a lot. And Leviticus is the locus classicus of anti-gay scriptural arguments. But if you read Leviticus, if you read all of Leviticus, Leviticus abounds in abominations. There are abominations all over the place. Just about everything in Leviticus is abomination. And they all call forth the same penalty. I mean, the people who were writing the Old Testament did not have great imaginations. They didn't take modern criminology, and they weren't, you know, thinking about early release, and they weren't thinking about alternative incarceration and things like that. It was pretty much be put to death. Along with the begetting and begetting, in the Old Testament there's a lot of smiting and smoting. So here are some of the other abominations in Leviticus. Seeing one's family members naked is an abomination, which is cause for death. Eating fat. And we of course know about all the dietary restrictions in the Hebrew Bible, which, you know, we pretty much, many of us have sort of rejected or don't really stick to anymore. But those are taken very seriously, and there's many more verses and much more discussion of dietary restrictions in the Old Testament than there are of sort of sexual restrictions. Touching the bed of a menstruating woman can be penalized by death. Having sex during menstruation, also. And cursing one's parents. All of those things are abominations in Leviticus that are cause for death. Now, some theologians who look at Leviticus with slightly different eyes believe that this was part of the Hebrews' rejection of religious practices of neighboring cults. The Old Testament is often looked at as the attempt of the Hebrew society to distinguish itself culturally and religiously, its practices, from those tribes or those cultures around it in a fairly hostile world and a fairly hostile time. And a lot of the religious cults that were not Hebrew cults practiced things like ritual prostitution, or what was called cultic prostitution, in which males would be used in religious rites as prostitutes. And this is the kind of prostitution, and this is the kind of same-gender relations that is really, that Leviticus really zeroes in on, and that the Old Testament really zeroes in on. And the people who wrote the Hebrew Bible were trying to distinguish, to a certain extent, Hebrew and or Jewish religious practices from the religious practices of those around them. So there are sections in the Old Testament, for example, where this kind of same-sex contact is, or this kind of male prostitution, is condemned, but same-sex relations themselves are not. And there are, again, people who have read the Old Testament carefully have picked up various hints in other places of sort of same-sex, not only sexual relations, but relations of love, romantic relations between Abraham and a slave, and in other examples in the Old Testament. So it's not that clear that reading the Old Testament, it's sort of an undiluted message of condemnation of homosexuality. But those two passages in Leviticus are still very powerful. And some feminist Jewish theologians and rabbis are struggling a female rabbi. So compared to a total of 4 scattered references to same-sex relations, Leviticus alone contains more than 10 prohibitions against sex during menstruation and 17 verses on how to make a grain offering. So if you don't want to go to hell, you should really be much more careful about what you do with your baked goods, really, than what you do in your bedroom. On the issue of adultery, for example, the prohibition is not on extramarital sex for men. Men are allowed to, especially men with property, can basically do as they please, as long as they don't have sex with the wife of another man. So the restrictions, even on adultery, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, in the Ten Commandments, are much more about violating the property rights of other men and men of the group than about men keeping faithful or fidelity within marriage. Okay, and I mentioned already the stories about the one king who had 300 wives or 200 wives and 300 concubines, and that's very common in the Old Testament. Okay, the New Testament it's just not as interesting, it's not as juicy when it comes to sexuality. Once you get past the first letter of St. Paul to the Corinthians, you know, there's not much there. But in that letter of Paul to the Corinthians, Hofner counts at least 17 sexuality topics. And of course, the very famous passage that provides the content of many wedding ceremonies about the nature of love. Love is not jealous, love is not fearful, and so on. So we're familiar with that. But the book of Paul's letter to the Corinthians is often used to condemn all sexual relations and placing celibacy in the most favored position, because Paul sort of had this hierarchy of sexual expression, that the highest thing, the best thing, the most godly thing you could do was abstain totally from sexual relations. The next best thing after that would be to have sex within marriage, and then you're really in trouble and risking things if you have sex outside of marriage. But even in Corinthians, Paul said that he realized that everybody couldn't be like him. See, Paul was, he was already pointing the way toward Unitarian Universalism. And he said, I may choose to be celibate, but that's not going to be the choice for everybody. But he did say, well, if you can't resist the temptations of the flesh, then get married. And by the way, I have a wedding ceremony for you right here in this letter. Okay, so we're moving toward, a lot of theologians now are moving toward a new sexual theology. And again, I would summarize what that sexual theology might look like. Theologian James Nelson says it might look something like this. It will be strongly sex-affirming, understanding sexual pleasure as a moral good rooted in the sacred value of our sensuality and erotic power, and not needing justification by procreative possibility. It will be grounded in respect for our own and others' bodily integrity, and will help us defend against the common sexual violations of that integrity. It will celebrate fidelity in our commitments without legalistic prescription as to the precise form such fidelity must take. It will be an ethic whose principles apply equally and without double standards to persons of both genders, of all colors, ages, bodily conditions, and sexual orientations. Hoffner concludes in her overview of her time spent looking at the sexuality issues in the Bible is that the Bible teaches that sexuality is a central part of being human, that bodies are good, that pleasure is good, that humans experience a healthy sexual desire of each other. Just as it is today, sexuality in biblical times was a source of pleasure and intimacy, as well as misery and distress. Those of us who are people of faith must spread the gospel, literally, the good news that the Bible affirms a healthy and positive view of sexuality. So next time somebody says to you that the Bible condemns this sexual practice or that sexual practice, you can tell them that that's really not the universally held opinion any longer. But it's still, liberals, religious liberals, and liberals in general do fight an uphill battle against the arguments of the religious right. And that's really what you have to contend with when you advocate for sexuality education, is because there is a lot of power out there, and there are a lot of forces, and some of that is just cultural traditions and practices that they're handed down, and it's hard to swim against that tide sometimes. And it's hard to be a religious liberal in the arena of sexual politics. There's another essay in this book called Sex, Life, and Liberalism by a UU minister named Arthur Vaney. And he talks about how we've been taught and how we've been conditioned to a certain extent to think of sex really as being sinful. And he tells a joke where a very nervous man appears before St. Peter at the pearly gates. And he's got St. Peter's going over a list in front of him, and Peter is kind of laughing and saying to the man, "No, that's not a sin either." And Peter finally says, "My goodness, you must have worried yourself to death." he also tells about he grew up as a Catholic, and he tells about his experience with sexuality education, sort of tongue-in-cheek, but he describes it this way. What he got in Catholic school was a two-hour lecture on sex education, which said it was okay to French kiss before marriage as long as both parties were immersed in separate baths of ice water. So he concludes that sex education was not intended to help us, sex education as some of us experienced it, those of us who did experience it, was not intended to help us understand ourselves as sexual beings, but to ensure we understand the narrow limits of acceptable sexual behavior. But, he concludes, sexuality is intrinsic to the human experience. Hiding from it only serves to make us vulnerable to its misuse as a source of power over rather than power with others. Okay. One of the other topics, another topic that's dealt with in the manual is supporting sexuality education in your congregation. And I don't have to say a great deal about that, because in this experience over the past year in proposing the OWL program, in dealing with the Religious Education Committee, in presenting these services, and then in teaching the OWL program, I don't think I've heard really any powerful objections. It's been so easy at Prairie to get this program up and going, and I think that's remarkable. I think even for UU congregations, it's kind of remarkable. Other congregations it hasn't been quite as smooth. Often you have to be very careful when you set something like this up. You have to make sure that you cover all your bases and that you are very careful with the way you go about it. But offering sexuality education is important, and we intend to continue to offer the OWL program at least for the youth, and we intend to also or make it available also to adults. To offer sexuality education in the congregation, according to Cynthia Breen, who's a UU minister, is to acknowledge that sexuality is simply too important, too beautiful, and too potentially dangerous to be ignored in a religious community. Okay. There are supposed supposedly four steps that you're supposed to take before you, as you initiate a program of comprehensive sexuality education in your congregation, place like Prairie. One is building allies. So get people to support you. And also, while you're building allies, the flip side of that is identify possible opponents, or identify possible, not enemies, but people who might be opposed, people who have problems. And also to listen to those people and make sure those people are heard. And I hope that we've at least been open-minded and aware of people's concerns. Nobody has come to me personally and said, I have real concerns about what's going on with this program. But, you know, we should make people aware that if there are concerns, you know, that they will be listened to. The second step is forming an oversight committee. The third is educating and inspiring the congregation. And the fourth is making the program an ongoing part of the congregation's ministry. Now, I think we've done most of the first three, building allies, forming the oversight committee, we have the RA committee and also the teachers who've taught it, educating and inspiring the congregation. Well, we're educating here. You can decide whether we're inspiring or not. And then finally, making the program an ongoing part of the congregation's ministry. We're definitely on the road to doing that downstairs in the RE program, and perhaps there'll be the opportunity to do that throughout the entire congregation. I have a couple examples from other UU congregations, what they've done with introducing comprehensive sexuality education. First UU Church in San Diego, for example, offers the exact same course concurrently to students, to youth and adults. So the parents are taking exactly the same sex education course that their children are. Because a lot of parents just missed out because they came from different religious traditions, or they just didn't get it in the schools, or somehow they were absent that day, and they didn't get sexuality education. And so this, you know, not only kind of brings the parents up to speed, makes them almost as wise as their children, but it also gives the children and the adults something, some common basis for discussion. And gives the adults, also the parents, more accurate information about the program. They come to know the program more intimately, more thoroughly. And that program in San Diego has made it easier for the congregation as a whole to address sexuality issues. And now each year the San Diego congregation, First Church in San Diego, I guess there are eight UU congregations in the San Diego area. Each year the congregation has what they call a Holy Family Worship Service, which celebrates families of all kinds. Single parent families, married or committed couples, same-sex couples, absent parents, singles, widowed people, childless people, adoptive and foster families. This idea of diversity, that families come in all different shapes and sizes and look all kinds of different ways, that everybody who walks in the door is valued and welcome, whether or not they have children, no matter how old they are, no matter what kind of relationship they're in, has really drawn together this congregation. First United Methodist Church in Germantown, Pennsylvania, has trained members of its congregation to become sexuality resource persons for the whole congregation. And so they go through a training, and if there are issues that come up about sexuality, they are sort of the contact persons for issues of sexuality. We sort of informally are doing the same thing through the OWL training. Randy has gone through the OWL training. Now we have a bunch of teachers who have taught the OWL curriculum. We're beginning to have our own sexuality resource persons in this congregation. Okay, the next section of the handbook is about actually going from the congregation into the community and navigating the political landscape. As a religious liberal, as a self-identified liberal and a self-identified religious liberal, and how you combat, how you get your message out into the public sphere, and how you lobby for sexuality education. And one of my favorite essays and sections in this part of the book is called Public Speaking Tips About Homophobia for People of Faith. It's by Meg Riley, who's the chair of the Office of Faith in Action of the UUA. And it's for people who have you ever felt sort of tongue-tied in a political argument? You begin to argue these issues or some political argument, and then you lose your train of thought and you get kind of tongue-tied. And then you kick yourself later when you know it comes into your head exactly what you should have said. Or worse, sometimes you get frustrated, you lose your cool, and you call the person a bigot or a racist or a homophobe or a sexist or something like that. And that's not really satisfying either. It doesn't feel good for you. It doesn't feel good. Nobody learns anything, and you feel, you know, kind of bad later. Or has anybody ever had a fantasy about being on Nightline opposed to Jerry Falwell? What would you say to him? Or what would you say to Fred Phelps, you know, if he, when he comes to town? He's been in town twice, right? Was he just in town recently burning the Wisconsin flag or something like that? Oh, people watching? Yeah, that's one thing. So I guess this would fit better if you're on Nightline opposite Jerry Falwell. But the following suggestions are from Meg Riley, and they're going to be, I'm going to ask for the help of Bev and Ann to... Yeah, you can come up here in front. These are the do's and don'ts of arguing with homophobes. Don't respond defensively to homophobic scriptural citations by engaging in a boxing match style of dialogue about them.
God made Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve.
That's ridiculous. The creation story is a myth to explain humans' creation. Scientific research shows that the first human was a woman in Africa.
Do use humor and a light touch.
God made Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve.
Are you saying that heterosexuals are responsible for the fall of humankind, then? I'll try not to be bitter.
Or?
Gay people don't have to act on their sexual desires. God can heal them.
But as I read scripture, just saying no didn't even work in the Garden of Eden.
Don't fight with an idiot. Someone watching the two of you won't know which of you is the idiot.
Gay people should all be killed.
It's people like you who should be put in jail. You're a danger to democratic society.
Do appeal to moderate observers.
Gay people should all be killed.
I know that the majority of Americans are as frightened by your words as I am. Every poll shows that we support fair, nonviolent treatment for all people.
Don't let someone else frame the debate.
Our founding fathers intended this to be a Christian nation, and the Bible clearly condemns homosexuality.
This is not a Christian nation, and never has been. Why, Thomas Jefferson explicitly said that...
Do speak positively and stay on track.
The people who founded our great nation bequeathed us a constitution and a bill of rights, which clearly promotes freedom of religion. These documents provide the basis of our covenant for living together in peace. That is why we are concerned that our community is being divided by anti-gay violence and fear.
Don't demonize or insult anyone.
I just don't think gay people should have special rights.
Only a bigot or homophobe would say that.
Do differentiate leaders from followers. Use language of reconciliation and compassion.
Concerned that Americans who strongly oppose discrimination are being misled about exactly what that means. Equality is not a special right.
Don't allow homophobes to monopolize religious language.
God's word is good enough for me. To be gay is an abomination.
Regardless of what you read in the Bible, this is not a Christian country, and the Bible should not govern our laws.
Do claim the high ground. Cite scripture. Use your own religious language.
Jesus never mentioned homosexuality at all, but he does say to love your neighbor as you love yourself, and that's how I try to live.
Or?
The God I know is a God of love, who does not see any person as an abomination.
Don't allow the debate to be framed as religious people versus secular gays.
Religious people are concerned that militant gays will destroy our families.
We're here, we're queer, get over it!
Do speak openly about your faith as it informs your commitment to GLBT issues.
In my congregation, we are concerned about the high incidence of gay bashing in our town. We feel that we best embody God's radical commitment to love by teaching our youth that violence and intolerance are neither moral nor acceptable.
Don't get sidetracked into discussions of whether people choose to be homosexual or what percentage of the population is gay.
Homosexuals could change if they wanted to.
You're either born gay or you're not. Why, studies show that.
Do stay focused on your own talking points.
Americans deserve equal treatment under the law. People could choose to change religions or marital status, but that would not make discrimination against them acceptable. While we still don't know much about the cause of sexual orientation, Americans do know that discrimination is wrong.
Don't try to terrorize people onto your side.
We are in pre-Nazi Germany, and you have a chance to vote against Adolf Hitler.
Do present a vision of unity.
In times like these, we all need each other. Candidates like X divide us from one another and waste our precious resources.
Thank you. Other chapters of the book and other things that this handbook focuses on and presents are how to build coalitions, education and media campaigns, pitching reporters, working with school boards, lobbying, writing your legislators. And then the book concludes with two case studies saying what can be accomplished when religious organizations, UU or otherwise, enter the debate about sexuality issues. Not all localities are as fortunate as Madison to have so many services available and liberal thinking available, but even in Madison, there's only one abortion clinic that's open right now, or one abortion provider, right? And that provider is under threat or of being evicted from Meritor. And so even in Madison, you know, things could be better. But in a place like Henderson, Kentucky, for example, was a metro area of 350,000 people with no family planning or reproductive health services for women. So in 1995, the Zion United Church of Christ congregation decided to open a Planned Parenthood clinic in its adjacent Peace and Justice Center. Even though the Planned Parenthood clinic did not provide abortion services, the religious right came out in force and opposed the siting of this Planned Parenthood clinic at a religious institution. And eventually, they got a lot of press, they made a lot of noise, but the people in Zion UCC in Henderson, Kentucky held their ground, and the center survived and still exists. Through this experience, the people of Zion came to realize how closely the issues of sexuality were to issues of justice, and it got them much more organized around justice issues and sexuality issues. The second example and the last example is between 1993 and 1996, the citizens of Hemet, California successfully organized to end the use of an abstinence-only curriculum in public schools. The district had been using Phyllis Schlafly's Sex Respect curriculum, which had its opponents contended a religious bias, it counseled overtly against abortion, it perpetuated damaging stereotypes, and gave inaccurate medical information. An interfaith community alliance was formed after opponents of the curriculum were labeled as immoral, godless liberals. And no clergy in this conservative town in Southeast California would join the group, and they were bounced from church to church. They failed narrowly to dislodge the conservative majority on the school board, but in the meantime, 11 parents sued the district over sex respect, and backed by Planned Parenthood and People for the American Way, the suit was settled and sex respect was removed from the schools in Hemet, California. So if in a small conservative town in Kentucky and a small conservative town in California, if people of faith can organize around those issues when they see that questions of sexual justice need to be addressed, then in places like Madison and elsewhere, we probably have more power to accomplish what needs to be accomplished. Thanks.
Thank you, Robin, for that whole series, which has been wonderful. Robin has closing words.
The closing words I chose are from 19th century philosopher of liberty, John Stuart Mill, who wasn't a Unitarian himself, but he hung around with a lot of Unitarians. And he understood how difficult it was to be a liberal sometimes, because it meant challenging many of society's most cherished prejudices and running the risk of being labeled a godless elitist. And how difficult the job of the reformer is when people cling to their prejudices long after they have ceased to have any basis in reason or justice. And these are his words. The practical reformer has continually to demand that changes be made in things which are supported by powerful and widely spread feelings. And it is often an indispensable part of his argument to show how these powerful feelings had their origin. Every inveterate belief and every intense feeling of which the origin is not remembered is able to dispense with the obligation of justifying itself by reason and is erected into its own all-sufficient voucher and justification. There never was such an instrument for consecrating all deep-seated prejudice. This tendency is one of the chief hindrances to the rational treatment of great social questions and one of the greatest stumbling blocks to human improvement. It is a tendency so agreeable to human indolence, as well as to conservative interests generally, that it must be attacked at the very root.